Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. Welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me for another wonderful and inspiring conversation into subjects that you really must know because they will make such a big difference in your health and well-being. And it is such a pleasure that I have you with me here for the next hour. I have another inspiring conversation organized for you, and I know you will find it quite enlightening. And I trust it will give you some practical solutions for many of the health challenges that so many people are facing. And to help you understand more about the role of nerve damage, what's behind nerve damage? So what we're going to be talking about is the connection between sugar and nerve damage. And to help us understand this, I have as my guest, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Richard Jacoby, who is one of the country's leading peripheral nerve surgeons. He practices in Scottsdale, Arizona, and specializes in the treatment of peripheral neuropathy. He is also one of the co-founders of the Scottsdale Healthcare Wound Management Center, a diplomat of the American Board of Podiatric Surgery, and a member of the American Podiatry Association, the Arizona Podiatry Association, and the Association of Extremity Nerve Surgeons. And in addition to that, he is the co-author of Sugar Crush, How to Reduce Inflammation, Reverse Nerve Damage, and Reclaim Good Health. So we have a fantastic conversation in store for you. And it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Richard Jacoby. Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for your time today and for the wonderful book you have written. It's a book that I have been reviewing and I've been learning so much from. So I always love to find books that I can add to my knowledge base. And you've done a really great job. And I have to say, Dr. Jacoby, it's a really great read. And it's a book that certainly will inspire lots of people. So thank you. Thank you for the work that has gone into doing this, along with everything else you're doing. I'm always amazed how people find time to write books in the middle of everything else they're doing in their lives.
I was, too, because I always wanted to write a book, and I wondered how all these books got on the market. It is a labor of love, that's for sure.
Yeah, I don't know when you found the time. Did you just go away somewhere or just sneak it in? Or how did you find the time to put it all together?
Well, I'm normally dictating every day for my patients. So I write a lot of letters. And I just thought of this as a letter writing. So every day I would get up in the morning, I would chronicle my feelings of what I thought was happening, and I would do this at night as well. So I probably spent 2 to 3 hours every day reading and writing. But this has been going on for at least 3 to 4 years. Earnest writing took me about 2 years, and I had help. HarperCollins, my editor in New York, they're first class organization, so I didn't do it alone.
Well, it's good to have help, but you need to be doing the work, the bulk of it anyway. So it's a discipline, and I guess, I don't know if this is your experience, but when I was writing my books, you get into a flow, and it just starts to happen. It's like that creative process takes hold, and there's an energy that comes through that compels you to write.
It does. And of course, I'm getting that off my patients. So every day I have many patients that I've either never have seen that particular problem, so I had to go to the literature every day, and then I was educating myself in this new paradigm.
So it is a new paradigm for peripheral nerve surgeons, isn't it? Because like any of the traditional models, the allopathic model, it's not really a model that focuses on the causes, and especially the nutritional causes. So this is, I would imagine you're introducing this connection in some really important ways to your colleagues.
I am, and it actually is very difficult to get my colleagues to understand the interconnection. Most of allopathic medicine is, as you state, very effect-oriented rather than cause-oriented. And we're all treating different pieces of the puzzle. So we don't think there's any commonality. When you look at it from a different point of view, more of a naturopathic point of view, then you see cause and effect much clearer. When I first started doing the research on this, I even had a personal stake in the game. I was at the Scottsdale Healthcare's Wound Care Center, which I helped found about 25 years ago, and I had a gallbladder attack. And I went to the gym every day, had the quote-unquote American diet, and I didn't understand why I would have this problem. And one of my family doctor friends said, well, you don't eat enough. You don't eat breakfast. And I thought, well, maybe he's right. Started to look at that, and then I realized the gallbladder is a muscle innervated by a nerve. If it doesn't function right, it's not going to empty. So I looked at the autonomic nervous system. I ran into Dr. Dellen on a lecture from Johns Hopkins, and he introduced me to the concept of nerve decompression. And with that, I developed this theory. And we can get into the real basics of the biochemistry in a few minutes, but it dawned on me that most of the maladies in the body are really secondary to this nerve compression. That's why I call it the global compression theory. Let's take a look at the gallbladder. Gallbladder, about 800,000 excisions a year in the United States. Mm-hmm. My mother had her gallbladder out, but I ate the same diet she did, and it was probably way too many carbohydrates than we should be eating. So I looked at the biochemistry behind that, and I found a book written by Dr. Dick from Mayo Clinic. He is the world's leading authority on peripheral neuropathy, and in his book, he made the statement that 50% of people who have gallbladder disease go on to have diabetes. I'm in the wound care center looking at my patients. Mrs. Jones comes in, and she has a hole in the bottom of her foot, and she's got gangrene, and she's about to have an amputation. I went through her history, and I say, well, you had a heart attack, you had this, and you had that, and you had your gallbladder taken out 20, 25 years prior. And I went, oh, my God, is this going to be me 20 to 25 mm-hmm. years from now? So I took a very personal interest in this. The answer is sugar, and specifically, in my opinion, high fructose corn syrup, and it caused the biochemical changes of the nerve. Now, what's ironic, it's all in the literature. I didn't make any of this up. There's three biochemical pathways, and I don't know if you want to get into that right now, but that's what causes nerve compression. I went back go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think we absolutely should get into that because we all need to understand, myself included, what is some of the physiology that causes nerve damage. Before we go into that, can you give us some statistics? How serious is nerve, inflamed nerve conditions in this country?
Well, if you look at it from my point of view, it's probably the most serious disease in America, or actually the world today. It's a pandemic problem. From the diabetic standpoint, 350 million people worldwide have diabetes, and probably another 350 that are undiagnosed. So when you follow the food chain, you follow the disease of diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a sidebar to this, in 1981, I was asked by the then Surgeon General of the country in Taipei, in Taiwan, to come over there and take a look at their diabetes problem. I went there, spent 3 weeks, went all over the country, came back to his name is Dr. Luke Chu. He is a pharmacologist by training, MD, head of the National Defense Medical Center, and just about every other thing. I said, Dr. Chu, it's the diet. And he said, well, it can't be that simple. I said, it's that simple. The first fast food store, McDonald's, was put in 1979. I was there in 1981. They didn't have diabetes prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
2 years, they had it. They didn't even have words to describe the disease. I made up most of the words in Chinese for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's sugar. But at that time, I thought it was more the meat between the buns. Now mm-hmm. I realize it was the bun, the sugar in the bread that really is the cause. Now, omega-6, omega-3 fatty acids are certainly part of that in the meat that we're eating. Cattle are eating grains. Cattle don't eat grain as a normal diet. They're ruminators. They eat grass. So that is part of the equation. So how does it cause nerve compression? Well, that's what I've done for the last 30 years, trying to figure that out. So there's three pathways. Number one, the polyol pathway. Simply put, when sugar gets inside the nerve, it goes through an enzyme system, and it makes sorbitol, which is an alcohol sugar. Sugar alcohol is hydrophilic, meaning it pulls water into the nerve and swells the nerve. So that's point number one. Number two, the Maillard reaction, which is really a cooking term, sugar plus a protein. It makes that protein contract. A wrinkle would be a process, the same, cataract. But it also happens on the nerve. So you have a nerve and the covering of the nerve that's making it smaller. At the same time, the fluid inside the nerve is expanding, and those tunnels that these cables go through compresses the nerve. So let's talk about carpal tunnel of the wrist. And we'll segue back to Dr. Dellen from Johns Hopkins. And he introduced me to that concept in year 2000. And he is a plastic surgeon by training, and he's written most of the articles on peripheral nerve surgery, especially the carpal tunnel. Patient of his in the 1980s who had diabetes and carpal tunnel and ulnar tunnel at her elbow, he fixed her arm, and she said to him, "Why don't you fix my legs? I have the same problem there." He said, "Well, that hasn't been done, and it's a different disease." Then he thought about it and said, "Wait a minute, it is really the same disease." Some very novel experiments with rats and primates, he proved the double crush syndrome, which means there's more than one compression along a nerve. He did the surgery on this woman in early 1980, and then published his work in 1984. And that's what I do is the surgery. And we get about 80 to 85% excellent results with diabetic polyneuropathy in the leg to reverse the effects of diabetes, the same as the wrist. I came back to him about in year 2004, and I said, "Dr. Dellen, we get 85% excellent results. Why don't we get 100%? He didn't like that. And he said, "Why don't you figure it out?" The book is, I believe, how I figured that out. Started doing a literature search. I found Dr. John Cook at Stanford, cardiologist by training and a vascular biologist and PhD. He runs the lab that originally was run by Gerald Raven, who coined the word metabolic syndrome. And I texted him my concept in 2005, and he called me the same day he got the text. And he said, "I think you're right. Why don't we work on it?" We did. He has a very novel molecule, and we talk about it in the book, about the biochemistry. But he felt that my concepts were valid, and he said, "You need to publish this," and which is a very time-consuming, very laborious process, which would never get the information to the public. That's why I wrote the book. But very simply put, nerve compression in any tunnel causes end organ damage. So I went back to Dr. Dell and I said, "I think the peripheral nerve of the wrist and the arm and the leg and the foot are all the same, but why wouldn't every nerve in the body be the same? We may call it Bell's palsy, a compression of a nerve, the seventh cranial nerve in the face. So the muscle in your face doesn't work, so your lip droops and you drool. That's caused by sugar. Now, can it be caused by other things? Certainly, but the prevalence is extremely high with diabetics. It's sugar. I talk about Alzheimer's in the book. First symptom of Alzheimer's is loss of smell. That's the first nerve, cranial nerve, the olfactory nerve. The nerve comes through a very thin aperture in the bone in the brain. The nerve swells, It cuts out the blood supply to the nerve. You lose your first symptom is loss of smell. The later stages are loss of memory. So I went through in the book all the different nerves and hypothesized that this is all the same disease. It's sugar, and it causes swelling. You can call it autism. You can call it Alzheimer's, MS, ALS. It really doesn't matter. It's the same process. So that's how I got to this conclusion. Now, am I right? I think so. We need to do a lot more research to prove it. But this prevalence, let's take autism, for instance. In the year 2000, it was 16 per 10,000 births. Today, it's 1 in 50. Now, my critics say, well, it's better diagnosis. Do you really think doctors were that stupid 15 years ago? It's not a better diagnosis, a higher prevalence. High fructose corn syrup is prevalent in 80% of the food in the United States. And some papers say that it has a third of those 80% have mercury in the food. And that's because that's how it's processed. High fructose corn syrup uses mercury as a catalyst to extract the starch out of the corn. So then when you start to look at it from that point of view, the massive amounts of sugar that we're eating, processed with mercury, then throw in the genetically modified seed and the active ingredient of glyphosate from the Monsanto Roundup, we have a worldwide pandemic disease that dwarfs any other disease ever on planet Earth. And it's ridiculous to think that food is not causing this problem. So it's, that's what my message really is. It's the same disease masquerading under all kinds of different names. So I don't want to be like a sermonette, but that's where we're at today.
But, you know, and of course I would agree with you. And I think it's only now that we are understanding how prevalent the variety of conditions that we are seeing that are epidemic now are related to the introduction of sugar and high fructose corn syrup and the refined carbohydrates, which of course will raise insulin levels, has been to the wide variety of conditions that we're seeing. There's some, you know, core causes, and certainly sugar is one of them. I mean, I just think at some time the food industry will have to have a reckoning of what they have done, how they have literally wrecked the health of people around the world. The numbers are staggering as to the health status of people worldwide now.
No question about it. And who helped foster that image? The United States Department of Agriculture, the food pyramid, which is now the food plate. But if you look at it, 6 to 8 helpings of carbohydrates a day, everybody would be hard-pressed to eat that much. But if you did, I'm sure we could get you up to 350 pounds without trouble. Yeah. And that's what we're doing. The public is being told to eat carbohydrates, and that's exactly what you don't need to eat. Well, let's talk about Dr. Perlmutter, if your listeners are familiar with him. He wrote the book Grain Brain and his new book, Brain Maker. His thesis is very similar to mine. Wheat and carbohydrates cause inflammation, and the inflammation is really that biochemistry that we were talking about. And the way I look at it is we're just slowly, insidiously, and pervasively cooking all our nerves. It takes about 40 years to complete that process. Then you wake up one day and say, oh, I'm a diabetic. No, you were in the process of being cooked slowly. Now you're diabetic. But you can look back through your life and look at all these itises. Let's take migraines. I think that's a big marker on the way to diabetes, especially women, and there's probably an estrogen issue as well.
Which is pro-inflammatory.
Pro-inflammatory, but it's really a nerve compression. The occipital nerves in the back of the neck, and also in the nerves that come through the sphenoid sinus, and it's very inflammatory, and you have acute attacks. Recently, about 2 weeks ago, the Southern Plastic Surgery Journal had an article that had a 95% correlation between migraines and carpal tunnel. They felt that they didn't know what the cause was, but if they read my book, they will get the cause. Mm-hmm. It's sugar, and you have to understand that biochemistry. Now, why do I talk about
migraines? Can we go back? This is so interesting. Let's just go back to migraines in women. So generally, migraines happen before menstrual cycle, right?
Correct.
So what is going on before that menstrual cycle? Especially, obviously, if women are having migraines, there's something out of balance, and you know that may be triggered and caused by the foods, but also this imbalance of foods, this reliance on sugars and being nutrient deficient and driven by toxins and stress will create something that I've been writing about called estrogen dominance. So the hormones are way out of balance. And if women with PMS, which probably are the women who are showing up with migraines, because migraine is just a symptom of this imbalance, are having high estrogen levels, and estrogen is pro-inflammatory, compresses the nerves, this could be the link. Am I correct in assuming that?
Because I think you're very correct in assuming that. One of the big problems with women, which is probably about two-thirds of the patients with pudendal neuropathy. Are you familiar with that one?
No. What's that?
Pudendal nerve is that nerve that you're sitting on. It goes right along the ischium, that bony prominence on your backside.
Mm-hmm.
Thought to be a traumatic neuropathy. People who bicycle a lot or a tough childbirth or trauma. But it really is an inflammatory condition, and it is extremely common, misdiagnosed, because a host of different doctors are going to treat that condition, gynecologist, neurologist, pain doctors. So it gets misdiagnosed. If you look at it through the prism that I just talked about, the biochemistry and food and sugar, then it becomes crystal clear that it's nerve compression. Dr. Dellen from Hopkins, he's written extensively on this. So if you want to really follow the anatomy carefully for your readers, just go to Dr. Dellen's website, dellon.com, D-E-L-L-O-N. And he does a terrific job on explaining that. But when you really look at all these different nerves, I mean, they're all the same. They go through fibro-osseous tunnels. The end organ is the only difference. It doesn't matter if it's toe or your finger or your eye, for that matter. Optic neuropathy is all part of this. I did a study with my patients using Dr. Cook's molecule at Stanford. This is where it gets a little confusing, but
okay.
It's
we'll
called,
hang in there with you.
Okay. Asymmetric dimethyl arginine. So let me clear that word up. That's a metabolite of the L-arginine nitric oxide pathway. So when that molecule builds up in your blood, and we don't know exactly why it does, but my supposition is that it's high fructose corn syrup, and it causes blockage of that pathway. So let's call that ADMA, asymmetric dimethyl arginine. So it blocks that pathway. L-arginine, which is a semi-essential amino acid, meaning that you can get it in your diet, but you have to manufacture it as well, you need to have high levels to have good health. And it converts to nitric oxide. If it does, you'll have plenty of blood supplied to any organ, any nerve. But ADMA blocks that, and that then will make peroxynitrite, which is very inflammatory and also shuts off the blood supply. Fibromyalgia would be a good example. that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's stopping the nerve supply to the skin. Mm-hmm. That's why you hurt all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And women have more of a problem because of the estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years ago, people with fibromyalgia were considered crazy. There's no diagnosis. Well, there is a diagnosis. We can do a biopsy of the skin. You can see the loss of unmyelinated fibers in the skin, and it's called small fiber neuropathy. Then you look at the biochemistry, your ADMA levels will be elevated. What's the cause? Sugar. Now, the hard part is how do you get off of sugar? Because it's so pervasive in our diet. It tastes so great, makes you feel so good like any other drug. It's difficult to get off of. Because when you get off of it, then you have withdrawals. You feel lousy, lack of energy, headaches. So you eat more sugar. And it's up, down, up, down. So your doctor, allopathic doctor, is going to put you on a mood-altering drug. Well, that's because you're eating sugar. It compounds the problem. So we have to get the cause. And the cause is the food. Now, my patients always ask me, well, what's the perfect diet? And I said, well, if it tastes good, don't eat it unless you read the label, because I guarantee you it has sugar in it. So that's one of the big problems, the sugar. But the sugar-fat hypothesis, just today I was looking at the television, and there's an ad for Cheerios, heart healthy. Well, to me, that is, I don't know what the right word for it is, but we do have the Federal Trade Commission. They ought to be looking at that.
Right,
so I've got to be very careful in my language here, but it seems to me sugar is what causes heart disease. Two-thirds of people that have myocardial infarctions have elevated sugar.
Mm-hmm.
50% of them have elevated cholesterol. The other 50% who have heart attacks have low cholesterol. Cholesterol has nothing to do with heart attacks.
Mm-hmm.
It's sugar causing inflammation of the lining of the blood vessel. And that ADMA comes in on that equation, blocks the nitric oxide pathway, causes narrowing of the vessel, and then a heart attack. The end organ. What's the end organ? It's the muscle. It's the heart. No different than the toe or the wrist. Same disease, same process. But it's not cholesterol. So mainstream medicine puts you on a statin drug. What does a statin drug do? Lowers the cholesterol. That's great, but you need cholesterol to make your sex hormones. And then we get into all those things you just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to do that. If you want to lower your cholesterol, eat eggs. Well, that's crazy, isn't it? Well, it's not crazy because an egg is the perfect food. So if you eat cholesterol, your liver says, well, I got enough cholesterol, I don't have to overwork. So it's just a chain reaction that goes on and on and on. If I went back through the literature, because I had to educate myself on this, and I said to myself, well, how did this ever get started? And I think you probably know this guy's name, Ansel Keys.
Mm-hmm.
There's our boy. He's a famous nutritionist, and he said through his seven-country study that cholesterol was the animal fat was the problem. But he didn't tell us about the other 15 countries that he left out, which was sugar. So that started this whole cascade when the pharmaceutical companies to say cholesterol is a problem, we'll find drugs to lower it, and you go ahead and eat what the USDA tells us to eat, which is nothing but sugar, we'll handle it from Big Pharma, and now we have a national health crisis and a national disgrace.
Yeah,
people in the United States are fat and they're sick. They're not thin, and they're not healthy. It's destroying the country.
You know, I recently saw a report out of Australia, and they are – well, there were two reports recently out of Australia, which just so happens, but I know it's also happening here. And the one report was this growing incidence of early dementia and Alzheimer's in 50-year-olds, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, which we know is – related to everything you're talking about. And the other story that was really interesting is that they are considering raising the retirement age in Australia to 70. But they're saying the health of people at 40 now is so compromised, people will never make it to 40. I mean, to 70.
That's correct.
You know? So our health, our health status is declining, even though we may be living longer, but the quality of our health is actually declining to make us more of an invalid, bedridden by the time we get to that age. So it's kind of a misunderstanding of what our real quality of life is and what's happening to our bodies. So it's just affecting us on so many levels. It's compromising every aspect of our culture.
There's sugar. No question about it, and it's causing a tremendous burden on our healthcare system.
It's failing, basically. It's failing us.
It's failing us. That's correct.
You know, a couple of questions I have. Number one, we talk about sugar, and you see the connection with high fructose corn syrup. Now, do we also throw in refined carbohydrates? Do we throw in other forms of carbohydrates that maybe the starchy forms that people can't manage? Do you include them in this, you know, this category of sugar that we
yes.
need to be aware of?
Yes. Yes, all sugars are part of the equation. Human beings don't need much sugar. However, human beings, when they can get access to sugar, will overdo it. It's because it tastes great and makes you
feel
good.
And it's addictive. It's addictive in our brain.
Right.
I just want to say that I was reading your book, and I flipped through a section and talked about some of the consequences of sugar, and I came across a paragraph that talked about the impact of sugar on skin, and you were talking specifically about skin tags. So a lot of people have these little excess skin, and particularly I think you said it was around the neck or under the arm, which is really interesting because just around that time I was noticing that I was getting what I would call some of those skin tags on my neck. Now, I don't eat sugar, Dr. Jacoby. Mm-hmm. Well, let's just say I have some dark chocolate. That's my source of sugar primarily, but I don't do a lot. But they were showing up. So based on what I read in your book, I started to add a supplement that helps with a blood sugar regulation. So it had a formula that had a variety of herbs and vitamins, things that could help regulate my blood sugar. And you know what? Within less than a week, they disappeared.
Really?
Ooh, yes.
Let's talk about
I have you
supplement.
To thank for that. You can
well,
add that
you.
In the next book. No, really, it was quite profound. I realized it wasn't so much that I was eating a lot of sugar, but obviously I do not have the adequate minerals, vitamins. I'm not getting enough in my diet to manage my blood sugar levels, which as we age gets more compromised. We can have more insulin resistance as we age due to just growing older, and we need to manage it. So I've incorporated that formula as part of my core protocol now.
Excellent. Well, I'm working on the skin biochemistry as we speak. I've theorized over the years, let's talk about basal cells. I think there's a big combination going on in the artificial environment. Most people, and this is very prevalent out here in Arizona, we're inside. We don't get enough sunlight because it's dangerous. It's too hot. So we're inside under artificial lighting. Now, this is just my theory, but I found some articles that might support this. So fluorescent lighting has a different wavelength than natural light. So you're inside all week, and then you go out on the weekend. So the chromatophores, the dark pigment in your cells, they are turned on when you get out in the sun for 2 days, and then you're back inside for 5 days, and the different wavelengths turn it off. There is some good evidence that when you have high levels of omega-6 fatty acids subjected to different wavelengths versus omega-3, it can change the DNA. Mm-hmm. That's the epigenetic issue, which is a whole other subject in epigenetics, but it is part of this discussion. So skin tags, basal cells, skin problems, vitamin D, the proper oils in your body, and on your skin are extremely important to health. There's a gal at MIT, Stephanie Seneff, and you may know her name.
Yes.
And she feels that cholesterol sulfate rafts in the blood. What she means by this is you manufacture this on your skin, the vitamin D, and it's a little package, and then it transports your good cholesterol to your heart for the muscle to use, and it transports that back to your liver to be reprocessed to make new stuff. Because the water or the blood is a water-based environment, and you need a fat lipoprotein to transport that. So when we mess with Mother Nature and alter these very tiny little changes, have magnitudes of change in outcomes. And I think basal cells is part of that. Skin tags is another one. So it's just obviously not just sugar is multifactorial, but sugar and specifically high fructose corn syrup is so pervasive in our diet. A couple other things I found in the, when I'm looking at these different issues, because I like to eat eggs, but you want to eat grass-fed eggs, not grain-fed. Grain-fed, first of all, chickens are vultures and from the vulture family. So they eat and peck at anything, and they like worms and bugs. They even eat scorpions out here. That's the only natural predator to a scorpion. And they're going to make omega-3 fatty acids and other nutrients in their eggs. That's why that egg yolk looks so orange in natural eggs versus that pale yellow in grain-fed. When I was looking at this epidemic we just had with, or having, with the bird flu.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
An egg takes about 30 days to go from an egg to slaughter now in those CAFOs, those pens that they raise them in.
Mm-hmm.
30 days. One of the ingredients they use is arsenic.
Yes, as a growth promoter, right?
Right. So if you're, and I was thinking about the sugar. Sugar is a poison, and arsenic is a poison. Both are sweet, by the way. Arsenic is sweet.
Oh, interesting.
And they give it to the chickens, and that makes them hyperactive, and they can't sleep, and they're awake 24/7. They never sleep for 30 days before slaughter. And we're eating that as a byproduct of chicken and eggs from that process. That can't be good.
Oh, my God. I never knew that it would make them hyperactive and keep them up for 24 hours a day. And I mean, that just puts a whole new spin on how abusive this whole system is.
And we're eating
this compromise. And they, of course, they're going to get sick because they're not healthy animals. If we ate arsenic and sugar all the time, well, look at us. We are. We are. Those chickens are like us. They're sick. How are you going to protect yourself from, how are you going to maintain a healthy immune system when you don't have the right components?
Right. So, let's look at pigs, the same thing. Pigs are omnivores. They eat scraps. They'll eat anything. But we feed them grains. Now, the difference is they don't get diabetes for the most part because they're slaughtered before that process is fully finished. But they're too young. But the omega-6 fatty acids and the hormones and all the additives and the antibiotics are in that meat that we're eating. So living in the United States, as I say, in the food grid is very difficult. And to get a natural diet is very, very difficult because we have a different lifestyle. Lots of us eat out many of our meals. So finding that right restaurant that has omega-3 grass-fed beef is difficult, and shopping is the same. So I use what I call the green, yellow, red. If it's a grass-fed, anything is fine. Eggs, milk, doesn't matter, meat. If they're eating grass, yellow means if they're eating grains, then that's going to be pro-inflammatory and not good. Not horrible per se, but not good. Red, I'm saying, is trans fatty acid. If they're being fed that, then that is poison totally and not to eat that at all. Mm-hmm. So when I'm shopping or eating out, I use that little signal. It's just going to be so difficult to read the labels. You're not going to go in the kitchen of most restaurants and ask them what they put in it. They probably don't even know themselves. So you have to seek out those restaurants that are trying and the food stores that are trying and or grow it yourself or raise your own chickens.
Yeah. You had a chapter in your book, or you had a section in your book I was reading that really was fascinating to me, and I think would be fascinating to my listeners. And you talked about the role of white blood cells and vitamin C and sugar.
Vitamin C. I don't know if your listeners remember Linus Pauling, but he is a big advocate of higher vitamin C levels in your blood. And white cells carry that vitamin C to a high degree. But when I was doing the research for the book, and I had remembered back from his book in 1974, that vitamin C molecule and glucose are very similar, it's about two carbons difference. So when, well, let's take orange juice as a good example. Your hippocampus in your brain, that's the little addiction guy, and he says, oh yeah, I need orange juice. Well, he wants the sugar. You look at it and say, oh yeah, I want some vitamin C, orange juice is healthy. So we drink orange juice, and we have a lot of sugar in there and a lot of vitamin C, but they're both mediated by insulin. So insulin comes out and says hello to vitamin C and hello to the glucose, and takes the glucose into the cell at the expense of vitamin C. And we wash the vitamin C out of our bodies, which lowers our immune system, among many other biochemical pathways, one of which I think is the nitric oxide pathway. Again, this is a little technical, but back to L-arginine.
Mm-hmm.
L-arginine converts to nitric oxide and or peroxynitrite. But there's a little coenzyme called tetrahydrobioturon. Big word, we'll call it BH4. And basically, it's made up of B6, B12, folic acid, and lo and behold, vitamin C. It's my contention, and I don't have the scientific proof for this, but I'm pretty sure this is what's happening. Vitamin C levels in people who have diabetes are very low. You downregulate BH4, and as you downregulate it to BH3 and 2, you don't convert L-arginine to nitric oxide. You convert to peroxynitrite, which is very vasoconstrictive to all end organs, and that's part of the disease process.
So just to kind of reiterate that, when you are lacking B6, vitamin C, folic acid, all of which, by the way, are depleted by sugar, correct?
Correct.
So we're nutrient depleted of these key vitamins that are necessary for the enzyme to be activated to enable us to turn to create the nitric oxide, which is allowing our blood vessels to dilate properly, and instead we're turning it into the nasty form that is causing constriction, which is stopping the nerve impulses getting through to the various organs and systems of the body. Do I have that right? Did I miss something?
You
there?
Did that.
I think
perfectly.
I missed something.
No,
did I?
You did it perfect. No, that's perfect.
Okay. Just that's, I mean, when you get that, when people get that, all these foods that are, that we're depleting these key essential nutrients for our bodies to function, you can see where it becomes the root cause that is generating whatever name you want to put on a disease condition. It doesn't matter. It is, bottom line, the body's struggle to manage to function because it is so depleted and starved of nutrients.
Absolutely. So we're not deficient in Lyrica or Neurontin or one of those drugs.
Mm.
We're deficient in the proper nutrients in the biochemistry. So sugar is the key in any form. Doesn't matter if it's, I get this question often, it doesn't matter if it's honey, agave, natural sugar, brown versus white, et cetera, it's still sugar.
Right.
Are we
okay.
going to eat sugar? Yes, of course. But it's a poison. You have to be very careful.
So let me ask you this really important question because I want to be sure we cover this. So we've talked about how nerve damage from sugar, and I really like that image that sugar is creating a hydrophilic, it's attracting more water into the nerves, which is like a balloon building up, water balloon that's pressing.
Perfect
creating
metaphor.
Compression.
Perfect.
Okay, good. So what So here's a question. Can nerves be rehabilitated? Can we heal the damage to nerves, such as found in peripheral neuropathy, that is such a big problem for people, or any nerve damage issue?
And the answer is yes. Depends on the phase. So I'd like to put peripheral nerves into five phases. In the beginning phases, where you're getting these little zingers in your feet, which has a name, by the way. I like the name. The name is called formications. I like that. You have to parse your lips when you say that with an M. So you're being formicated by your sugar. And it comes from the word formic acid, ants biting. So it feels like ants are crawling on your leg. That's the first sign. They come and they go. That's phase one. That's telling you those little axons, the little nerve fibers, are dying back. Mm-hmm. Phase two would be they're more common, much more intense, but it's an impending problem. When you hit phase three, it's constant. It doesn't go away. I usually see patients that are on Lyrica or some other drug to take the pain away. And then they come in phase four, and they tell me, well, doctor, I'm getting better because I don't have much pain anymore. I'm really kind of numb. Phase five is I'm completely numb. I have no feeling, but what's that hole in the bottom of my foot? Mm. And they go on to get gangrene and amputations, about 100,000 a year. Mm. So what to do when you get those first formication signals?
Mm-hmm.
See, not your allopathic doctor, because he's going to put you on Lyrica to allow you to eat more sugar or metformin or some other silly drug.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do I use those drugs? Of course I do. I can't treat everybody naturally, and it depends on the phase. But I tell everybody that's what they need to do. When you hit phase three, then it's a surgical problem. We need to do the decompression surgery. And if you can get to the nerve in time, yes, you can avoid an amputation. But most people like to let it go to the end phase, and that's why we have so many amputations. By the way, it's 1 million amputations worldwide now per year. That's a big number.
Yeah, I know so many people with amputations. My family.
Mm-hmm. And they're avoidable.
Yeah.
But it has to be treated as an addiction, which it is.
So what are your favorite strategies for helping people to get off the sugar addiction?
Well, my personal one, and I did this myself because I did not think I was addicted to sugar. So I thought, well, I'm eating too much bread. I'm from Philadelphia originally, and I grew up with that. So I'll just go off of bread. Well, I felt like I was going to fall into a coma, had no energy, had a dull headache, and it was very difficult to do. So what I do, put more fat back in my diet, and the number one process that helped me was hot butter coffee, putting butter in my coffee. And that's what I do. It cut the craving for sugar. I lost weight immediately, about a pound a day. And I had tremendous energy, and I never felt a need for food. I mean, really, it's just you lose that craving. So that was a godsend for me. Can everybody do that? No. Most people need to do an incremental approach, but I like what I called cold turkey, and I just got off of it.
And that buttered coffee, I mean, that's what they're talking about in the paleo diet, this bullet approach. You know, it could be coconut oil in your coffee, right? It doesn't have to be butter.
Correct. I've tried both. I like butter. I like this Italian butter. It comes out of Italy called Delitia, and it's made from buffalo milk, and they make the Parmesan cheese out of that. And it's a very creamy butter. It tastes delicious. Some people like Kerrygold. To me, it's a little greasy. But everybody has their own formula. Some people blend it. Some people mix it with coconut oil. But the key point is you can get off of sugar, but it's not easy. You have to treat it as an addiction, which it is. You'll have to go through withdrawal. But on the other side is a new life.
Yeah, so it must have been quite profound transformation for you.
Absolutely.
After you went through that withdrawal period, which I guess you were expecting something might be happening.
I thought it would be easy. It wasn't easy, but it took about 3 weeks.
Right, to get your energy back. And then doing that ketogenic approach where you're getting your energy from your fats as nature intended rather than from sugar.
That's exactly right. And the ketogenic diet, and that segues over to this cancer issue with sugar.
Yes.
And your listeners should know this, and it's true. 1931, Otto Warburg got the Nobel Prize in Chemistry because he wrote a paper on fructose and the link between fructose and cancer. Cancer cells can only live on sugar. They cannot live with the absence of sugar. You produce ketones, which kill cancer cells. Ask any oncologist, and they'll say to you, who is he? Well, he got the Nobel Prize in Medicine, not the Marvell Prize, Nobel Prize. Interesting guy, because his dad was a chemist, and he was good friends with Albert Einstein. And he got the Nobel Prize, and three of his students got the Nobel Prize, two of which you know, Hans Krebs, Krebs cycle, and Meyerhoff.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting little group of people.
Yes. Interesting, yeah, and the frightening thing is that cancer cells, I heard this statistic, has 10 to 15 times more receptor sites for sugar than healthy cells. That, you know, they demand sugar, they must be fed sugar, they can only survive by ensuring there's plenty of sugar.
Right, and that's what a PET scan is. You're looking for the mitochondria. If they're turning over sugar twice as fast, then that's a cancer cell. So I use an analogy. If you had roaches on your floor and you did a PET scan and you found where the roaches are congregating, that's where the sugar is.
Yeah.
We spray them with Raid and come back 6 months later and do another PET scan. Well, it's kind of crazy. Wouldn't you sweep up the sugar first? I mean, Maria Shenick, who's an investigator at Barrow's Neurologic Institute in Phoenix, looked at that same question a couple of years ago on glioblastomas, which is a deadly tumor of the brain. No one survives that. And she put her mice on ketogenic diet, continued with the same chemotherapy. All of the mice died without the ketogenic diet. 80% of them lived on the ketogenic diet. But what do we do?
I interviewed Dr. Thomas Seyfried a while back.
Yeah, perfect example. Yeah.
Yeah, so he is an amazing doctor, researcher, really a researcher, looking at the ketogenic diet for an understanding how that will address and help prevent cancer. And, of course, he worked initially with epilepsy and the ketogenic diet on epilepsy. And, I mean, it's all coming back to the same thing. We've got to get back to a truly healthy diet, back in time when our ancestors ate real food.
Well, if it wasn't for people like you, this story would never get out. I was interviewed by ABC News, Vogue magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, all liked the story, but I could tell by the interview, no one's going to hear this through those organizations.
Is it because they can't?
Their advertisers are all about food.
Yes, yes. So they are caught in that corporate web.
Corporate web, the truth is not being told, and our government is fostering and abetting this disease. On one side, they say you're fat and sick, and you need to get healthy, as if you're going to go out and run every day. I like this little analogy. Your grandmother, she wasn't overweight. Her dress size was size 4 in World War II. Dress size today is size 16. Your grandmother didn't run. It's not exercise, it's food. It's really, really simple.
So do you suggest if people, you know, as a practical strategy is bring more of those healthy fats, you know, whether you want the really good quality butter, whether you want the really good quality olive oil, the good quality coconut oil, stay away from the seed oils, don't, because they're the omega-6s that are very pro-inflammatory. And then, you know, try to, you know, buy your food from your local farmer's market. You know, have your organic veggies, your organic eggs, the grass-fed meat, if people, which I think there's a place for good quality protein in one's diet, and however you get it. And we just have to learn to totally stay away from anything packaged and pre-prepared. We have to wake up.
You said it perfectly. It's exactly what you have to do.
You know, and I think this is where some good quality nutritional support and the supplements can help add the additional nutrients that we need so our body can heal and repair. But it's such a wake-up call, and you have done such a profound amount of research to make it very simple for people.
Well, I hope I did. Its book is selling very, very well. I haven't done those interviews that I have done have not made it to the mainstream for the reasons that I just said.
Yes.
And I understand that they will block me because it's big business, big pharma, big agri, big government. That's what we're fighting.
So have you been on Dr. Oz yet?
I don't know that he needs me to add to his controversy, but I would like to do that.
He'd be a perfect vehicle. But it is a grassroots movement, and it is people like me who are out there trying to communicate, educate, and empower people with truthful information.
Absolutely.
Because you have an important message, and you have such credibility that it just makes people listen, pay attention. And especially when, it's such a wide-reaching paradigm that you're talking about, like all damaged nerves impair the function of all the organs and systems of the body. That is such a huge message.
It is, and it seems to be so fundamentally simple that it is profound.
Yes.
It would be illogical to think that the biochemistry we just talked about is only going to apply to the lower extremity. That would be illogical. But that's how it's looked upon by the American medical paradigm.
Well, gosh, this has been such a fantastic conversation. I so appreciate everything you've been doing. I've learned so much from you, and I think everyone needs to get your book, which is available at sugarcrushbook.com. Correct?
That's correct.
Okay,
or you can just Google Sugar Crush Book, and it comes
pick it up. Pick it up Amazon or go to the website sugarcrushbook.com. We're at the end of the show, Dr. Jacoby. I just so appreciate the amount of work, research, and the mission you are on, and I will do everything I can to help spread the word, and I'm sure my listeners will as well, and we are getting the message out and making a difference.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the work that you are doing. Otherwise, this message would not get out.
Well, we're the underground rebels here, so we're doing our best. So, Dr. Jacoby, thank you so much for your time today. I really encourage everyone to pick up a copy of Dr. Jacoby's book, Sugar Crush, How to Reduce Inflammation, Reverse Nerve Damage, and Reclaim Good Health. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know with my guest, Dr. Richard Jacoby. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.